And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I am here sitting around the table after Thanksgiving. Hopefully we are all well recovered. With the Pop Culture Happy Hour team. How's it, everybody?
I just woke up.
It's been a five-day turkey
a long winter's nap.
My exercise regimen in general consists of napping after every meal.
Oh, and that so. Napping after every meal can only be Stephen Thompson.
Oh.
Stephen, yes. Why don't you tell the nice people what you do?
Well, I am an editor at NPR Music.
And sitting next to you is Trey. Well, who are you, Trey, and what do you do?
I'm an editor for NPR on the website. I cover movies, theater, pop culture, that kind of thing.
And also help me out enormously with running Monkey See, where all you people are. Lovely people hearing us today. And how about you, Glenn? Who are you?
I'm a freelancer, actually. I work at NPR.
Like, I don't even work here.
Yeah, right. I just write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, that is awesome. Good to see everybody. And, you know, we actually, from time to time, try to do a little research for this podcast here.
No.
Wait, what?
Shocking, I know.
Lies?
We all...
Let's find out what
you have lies.
Anytime I can motivate Glenn to recite that for me, it makes me happy.
So let's find out what I haven't done.
Yeah.
Thompson, did you fall down on the job?
We'll see. What was I supposed to do?
Well, what we decided to do this week was see one of the movies currently making a little bit of a splash, which is Tangled.
Hey, I have Tangled. Done that.
You have
I
done
have
that.
I have seen Tangled.
Yep. You have seen it. Well, you do have the kids as an excuse.
So I couldn't go to the theater in a trench coat?
It would be pretty pitiful if you were like, I'm the one who has kids and I'm the one who didn't go.
Yeah.
That would have been weak.
But they're your human shield. So
Anyway, Tangled, as many of you may know, is the Disney retelling of what used to be called Rapunzel, but could not be called Rapunzel according to Disney, because then boys wouldn't go see it if it was called Rapunzel, so they renamed it Tangled.
Because boys hate girls.
Boys hate girls. Yeah. They hate stories about girls.
Strength. You know.
That's why iCarly has been such a massive flop.
I kind of wish boys liked girls less. I wouldn't have had to spend so much time watching iCarly.
Oh, iCarly's not about anyway.
iCarly's fine, but
all right.
Still.
So we all went to see Tangled, and I believe I was the first out of the gate and reported shortly after Thanksgiving that I had enjoyed it a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and,
as did I.
So that would be
praise
my,
indeed from
that,
you, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as many of you know.
Well, especially given that Linda was, you know, concerned at the announcement that they had to add an adventurous swashbuckler to, you know,
yes.
to the plot.
Did so they
the,
add
to appeal
an
to the boy
swashbuckler,
audience.
Or did they simply rename it and reemphasize?
Well, they sort of reemphasized his character exists in the story, in the original story, but is a prince and is a very different kind of guy. And mm-hmm. the whole thing, the idea of adding a thief so that you have another princess and thief story,
right.
which is
mm-hmm.
Certainly has been done plenty of times.
For example, in The Princess and the Thief.
For example, in Aladdin, which is also princess and thief and has some similar themes in that regard. But when they originally described the story at that point in the publicity for the movie, they described it as a story about this guy who meets his match and this girl who lives in a tower. And I was
right.
like, oh, how great.
Yeah, so it's like going to be all about him. And
it seemed like it was.
His boy troubles.
It seemed like it was. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think it really was about him. I think it still was really about her. I mean, it was about both of them.
Yep.
He's just there primarily to deliver wisecracks and get whomped with frying pan.
which is actually
my role in my day-to-day life.
Oh, my God.
Wisecracks and getting hit with frying pans. Oh, yeah.
Man, they loved that frying pan joke, didn't they?
Yep.
They did. So what did you think, Trey?
I was like you, surprisingly charmed by this movie. I think it's funny and fast and excessively postmodern, even compared to a lot of the sort of recent crop of animated quote-unquote classics. You have all these DreamWorks movies, the Shreks and,
right.
the, and the others.
Gag factories.
That are all about jokes and cynicism and commentary in quotes.
And pop culture references.
And pop culture
yeah.
references.
Smash
and
mouth
there's
montages.
Some of that. There's some of that here, but this is also a movie that's about character and about fantasy and about dreams, as they keep singing. Mm-hmm. It's a musical, by the way,
right.
Which we haven't mentioned.
First in a while, right?
It is.
First big musical. Some of these Disney, I haven't seen a lot of the Disney.
I think most of them have had at least a couple
the Princess
of
and the Frog.
Songs for
Princess and the Frog had some songs.
Grabbing the Oscar for that.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a little more classically a musical in that the characters will break into song to advance the plot. It's a little more in the Lion King, Beauty and the Beast.
Very, very much in the Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's about character. It's about fantasy. And yet it has a lot of the kind of modern humor that I think young audiences have grown up watching on shows like iCarly.
Right.
Modern humor, I mean, you have to be careful with that because it isn't pop culture references, but there is a sensibility.
Yes.
There is a sensibility.
Right. Yeah, it is not it's not actually a lot of
it's not about
culture.
Shout-outs, no.
It's not Robin Williams doing his Ed Sullivan, his incredibly fresh Ed Sullivan impersonation.
Or his Arsenio Hall, instantly dates that movie.
Now, that instantly, we should note, that instantly dates Aladdin. Do not skip Tangled thinking that Robin Williams is in it.
No. Yes, exactly. He's got a restraining order. He comes nowhere near this movie.
Well, and
he's not even allowed to attend it as an audience member.
His mustache is.
Yeah. I think the comedy in Tangled is a lot less gimmicky. Some of the comedy in some of the other Disney movies to me has been very much separate from the story. The comedy will come in these little segments that are very isolated from the rest of the story. To me, Aladdin is very much like that. Obviously, when you make Robin Williams your genie, you get that. But I feel like this one is very much, the comedy is very much a part of the conversations between the people, and it's very much the part of the characters. And
when one of those characters is a horse.
Love that.
We all love the horse.
Who does not love the horse?
God. Oh my God. The horse steals the movie.
The horse is the best.
Are you all tired from chasing this bad man all over the place?
Excuse me?
Nobody appreciates you, do they? Do they?
Oh, come on. He's a bad horse.
Look, today is kind of the biggest day of my life. And the thing is, I need you not to get him arrested. Just for 24 hours, and then you can chase each other to your heart's content, okay? And it's also my birthday, just so you know.
The horse is the best, of course, of course.
As much as they're in love with the frying pan joke, they are so in love with that horse.
Yeah, absolutely.
As was I.
How brilliant is the animation of that horse? I mean, the specificity of facial expression on the horse.
And not just the face, the physicality of the horse, the body language of the horse is so... so carefully thought out and so vividly expressed by the animators in this movie that it is clearly the thing that they decided was going to be one of the 2-3 centerpieces
that
of this movie.
And it's
they really love.
It's interesting because looking at the ads, I had figured that the little chameleon guy was sort of your token cute animal that was going
your
to charm
your
sidekick.
Your little gerbil in the bubble and bolts.
Wait, he wasn't the protagonist?
the crab and Little Mermaid.
Sure, exactly. And so you assume, but really...
It is that.
But the chameleon is more like the cockroach in Wall-E. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
It's true. The chameleon is a small role, but there are no small roles.
Yeah. But when the protagonist in Tangled, the female protagonist, Rapunzel herself, apparently is her name, when she charms the horse... Mm-hmm. I just wanted to hug the screen. Yeah. It was so delightful.
The physicality of the horse. I mean, we talked about the sensibility of this movie. The comic sensibility is there's dialogue jokes, of course, but there's also a lot of visual jokes, and the timing of these visual jokes is lightning quick. I mean, the way the horse moves is very, very fast, which in itself is funny. So,
and which I think
pervades the movie.
We talked a little bit about this on the way out of the theater. I think the timing, some of the physicality, and some of the shapes, the actual shapes of the drawings there are a lot of things that are references to not just classic Disney films. It has been pointed out that this is the 50th animated Disney feature, so there are lots of these references to things that have been not just in Disney films but in classic animation from all kinds of people, from the Looney Tunes cartoons to other animated movies from other studios. And I think those are very conscious, and I think they're about celebrating animation and how much the American movie-going public loves it.
I do think that Chuck Jones is a definite influence.
Well, Trey was talking last night when we saw this about the business about going out on the tree branch and the...
Oh, my goodness.
So Wile E. Coyote.
Which, as Trey said, is so Wile E. Coyote.
And there's an image near the top of the credits. There's a sketch of the horse, and he's heroic. He's sitting up on a promontory, and it, to me... the first thing I thought was Killed a Wabbit. It's the big horse with Elmer Fudd on top, right? Mm-hmm. Or is it Bugs Bunny with the blonde braid? I can't remember which. One or the other, that image very specifically being cited.
And speaking of the credits, they lead off with just three portraits of Rapunzel, Flynn, and the mother. And that's when it struck me, like, really, this film has been carried by three actors.
Oh, yeah.
There's lots of other people, but really, this film is really, it's on their backs. And I was struck by their vocal performances. I don't know this Zachary Levi guy. I don't watch Chuck. But this goes back to the sensibility. He's underplaying the comedy. He's letting it emerge. He's not lunging at the jokes. He's finding
very, very well acted.
Yeah.
Ah, there it is. The snuggly duckling. Don't worry, very quaint place, perfect for you.
I do like ducklings.
Yay! Gotham! Your finest table, please. You smell that? Take a deep breath through the nose. Really let that seep in. What are you getting? Because to me, it's part man smell, and the other part is really bad man smell. I don't know why, but overall, it just smells like the color brown. Your thoughts? Is that blood in your mustache? Goldie, look at this. Look at all the blood in his mustache. Good sir, that's a lot of blood. Hey, you don't look so good, Blondie.
He's a really... I want a nice word that means the same thing as ingratiating. He's a really...
I think ingratiating
He's a really likable, nice really warm actor.
And winning.
Winning.
There you go.
Exactly, there you
That's
go.
A good word.
I really felt like the combination of the way they animated this character so that he was able to have these sort of small and specific facial expressions. And I felt like the way that they did that combined with the way that, like Glenn said, he plays the comedy pretty small. I think it came out as a much more believable human.
There was nuance in the voice acting.
Right.
And I would also say, I mean, I don't think great script writing gets enough credit when an animated film is as successful as this
absolutely.
One is. As I recall, WALL-E was nominated for Best Screenplay. And as we've discussed on this show, I kind of felt the screenplay was far from my favorite thing about WALL-E.
Right.
And I thought this was very, very sharply written. You know, it's funny. I had heard all these great things about the movie. And in the beginning, I felt, boy, this is just Disney boilerplate. Mm-hmm. Man, this is just
the
Disney
opening. Boilerplate.
The opening. The, this is just lifted.
So if you see it, don't worry about the first 5 minutes.
For the first few minutes, you just feel like, I've already seen Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, there's so many tropes. Part of it is the product of the source material, and part of it is a product of this is, you know, there's the heroine who wants to see the world and sing songs about how she wants to see the world, but she's not allowed to see the world. I wish I could see the world. I guess I'll just read books. And...
Well, that's not entirely fair. She's a character who...
No, it is fair.
Nope.
Dre, shut
she's
up.
I'm gonna beat you with this roll of toilet paper that is inexplicably sitting in the studio.
That's a good question.
We were talking about screenwriting and what it contributes to character building. They very carefully, initially, right at the outset, given Mandy Moore and as Rapunzel a song that says, I am not just a girl who sits around the tower. I read books. I sweep. I do all the chores. I brush my hair. I paint the walls. I knit.
I play chess.
I felt like that was just a totally typical song of yearning.
It's just a song of yearning.
Play the song of yearning.
Sure, but
here.
It also says, I am not a moron. I am not passive.
They do that.
Right, but I don't want to downplay the fact that she is still a girl stuck in a tower. She's still a Disney princess. It's still a Disney movie.
She's very much a Disney princess.
But she's choosing to stay in the tower.
Right.
When she decides to leave, she leaves under her own power. The guy doesn't help her down. She uses her own hair to lower herself.
Yeah.
She is staying in the tower.
Every time I've used my own hair to lower myself.
Yes, well, weekly. She is staying in the tower for complicated reasons that are explicitly explained in dialogue.
Right.
And that's what I like about this screenplay.
They do a nice job, as the movie unfolds, of subtly explaining away moments where you're like, why doesn't she just do this?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep.
Why doesn't she just do that? Why don't they just, why doesn't she just cut her hair? Why doesn't she blah, blah, blah? And you see as the movie progresses, the why doesn't she just leave is very well
explained. And between the animation and Mandy Moore's vocal performance, it's convincing.
One of the things I like about the relationship between the two of them is that very often, I would say almost always, in movies like this, you get some version of the obstacle to the romance is I'm just a blah, while the other person is a blah. You know, like, he's a prince and I'm just a
common girl.
Yeah. I'm just a common girl who can't talk.
Right.
Right.
Or she's a princess and I'm a thief, Aladdin, or some similar variation on that. And what I like about this is that even though, I mean, certainly it's nothing you haven't seen if you've seen lots of romantic comedies, but they do weave in a couple of, to me, relatively credible issues involving trust and, you know, questioning people's motives and what are they there for, that to me are more interesting than those kind of
status.
For example, the way they establish the villainy of the mother is that she's just really selfish. And when she has an opportunity
and manipulative.
To manipulate it, and that's the key.
Welcome home, Mother.
Oh, Rapunzel.
So, Mother, as you know, tomorrow is a very big day.
Look in that mirror. You know what I see? I see a strong, confident, beautiful young lady.
Oh, look, you're here too. I'm just teasing. Stop taking everything so seriously.
When she has an opportunity to kill the dude, she decides it's much better to make her daughter not believe in him anymore.
Right.
Right.
That is a very important twist that gives the film a little bit more interest, I think.
And talk about performances. The woman who plays
Donna Murphy,
who is not a name that people will necessarily know, but she is one of those just yeoman performers in movies. Mm-hmm. All kinds of fantastic supporting parts, and sometimes the occasional romantic lead. Trivia, Spider-Man 2. Doc Octopus's wife.
Really?
Yes. Really? I knew I knew her from somewhere.
Also, in one of those latter day Star Trek movies, she's the alien that Jean-Luc Picard falls for.
Really?
On the planet where
in
the
Star
people
Trek
are
Nemesis.
Is that the one?
In Star Trek Nemesis.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that's
Star
Donna Murphy.
Trek Nemesis. I believe emerges from a pod.
The skill set.
Covered it, Steven. Move on.
But the skill set she brings to bear here is that she is one of the leading ladies of Broadway. She is one of the finest. She's one of the finest singing actresses working today.
She was in the original Chorus Line, wasn't she? I believe she was.
She was not in the original Chorus Line. She was Fosca in Stephen Sondheim's Passion, which is one of the great devils.
You know what's the same thing. We all have our own.
She's one of the great
survivor.
You know, excuse me, Brett Favre passed for 4,209 yards
exactly,
in 1997.
That's what we're saying.
My very
all
point.
The same
yes.
thing. That's what we're
short
saying.
Version. Amazingly talented True. Singing actress, and she's terrific in this.
My reaction singing when actress. I saw her in the credits was, I bet Trey knows who that is.
Yep.
Absolutely. Oh, yeoman performers. You know, I've been pretty vocal about being dissatisfied with princess movies.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And I think that although I still would like to see a little more branching out in terms of occupations.
For example, some occupation other than princess?
Yes, right. Exactly. I continue to feel that way. But at the same time, I did feel like this one kind of avoided some of the things that I dislike about
sure.
princess movies. She does have, you know, a certain amount of agency.
You know, it's been not a bad year or so for heroines with agency. You know, you had the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
You had the girl who was on fire in mm-hmm. the in the Hunger Games.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the girl with the fiber optic hair.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
All things for which my young daughter can strive.
Mm,
did they enjoy it, Stephen?
They loved it. They loved it. I mean, there's just nothing better than peering to my left and seeing my tiny little blonde 6-year-old girl with gigantic 3D glasses just giggling and giggling and giggling.
That's wonderful.
So they were delighted. They both my 6-year-old daughter and my 9-year-old son. And of course, taking them to a matinee only cost $40.
Well, you saw it in 3D.
We did see
right?
it. We yeah. did see it yeah. in 3D. Which
I've seen it twice, and neither time did I see it in 3D. And I'm not sure that I think I missed anything.
I saw it once in 3D and once in not.
Oh,
and,
good.
You know,
the usual
trade-offs are sort of there.
Yeah.
There is a little bit of extra wow.
Right.
Going on with the 3D, but
it's
my
darker, right?
It's darker, it's dimmer. The colors seem muted, and that actually plays off interestingly in a really lovely scene that's kind of the capstone of the film.
Yes.
With the lanterns,
yes,
floating over the kingdom and the castle.
You find yourself sort of letting your mouth hang slack a little
yeah.
bit during,
mm-hmm.
during
yeah.
that scene. But
but that scene plays
2D,
pretty beautifully
beautiful.
In standard.
So I think we're happy with that movie.
We are so
yep.
happy with this movie.
It's delightful. Yeah. I think people should see it.
Well done, Disney.
I'd rather see Tangled again than see Yogi Bear a first time.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah,
that looks that
prejudging.
Looks
prejudging.
I will continue to prejudge that movie. if you come back here and tell me you've got to see it, it's amazing, I will continue to not see it.
That's unlikely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right, so the next thing on our agenda this week is a little thing we're going to call People We Are Pulling For. And what we want to talk about is people who maybe we just have high hopes for them. They maybe are not, you know, currently massively powerful and famous and wealthy. Or maybe they are. Maybe you've got somebody who's just powerful and wealthy and down on their luck.
Mm.
You know? People we are pulling for. We're thinking of you. We're here with you.
We're on your side.
We're on your side. Okay. How about you, Glenn?
Okay. Well, you know, the universe showers attention and money and fame often on the wrong people, in my humble opinion.
You're kidding.
Not often enough on me.
You don't exactly. say.
And when it finally gets something right, it's like, way to go, universe. You got one right.
Mm-hmm.
I am a huge fan of the comedian Maria Bamford.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yes.
Sure.
Her stand-up is brilliant. It is funny. It's very smart. It's hilarious. What it isn't, The word you do not think of when you see her stuff is Hollywood. Yeah. You don't see her filling the niche like on the CBS Monday night lineup between Two and a Half Men and Hawaii Five-0.
Yeah.
You know, she's not going to play a harried single mom who's trying to juggle a publishing career with an adorable Moppet. That's not her.
She's not going to her show will not be paired with Reba.
Exactly. Oh my God, is Reba still on?
Yeah.
It's
at least still on syndication.
Anyway.
It's not.
We are more tangent filled than you can shake a stick at.
So, if you want to see what she can do, you should go to YouTube and look up the Maria Bamford Show. This thing she did with one single camera in 2006. She did 13 episodes. They're 5 minutes each. They're amazing. And the first episode is particularly one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
It's the Maria Bamford Show. I was a marginally successful comedian living in Los Angeles for 14 years doing stand-up, but I never got my own sitcom, and then my boyfriend turned out to be bisexual. And I forgot to pay my insurance premium, so I couldn't afford my medication for OCD, depression, and anxiety. So I started driving cross-country in a blonde wig and a bathing suit looking for angels with a drug dealer named Lips. And then my parents found me on a sidewalk selling clock radios in Detroit. They said, hey, why don't you come live with us in Duluth, Minnesota, while you try to get your medications kind of stabilized. And they took me back to their house where I'm living in the attic with my 11-year-old pug named Blossom. It's Maria Bamford Show. Hey!
So what happened last year to her is that she got some Christmas Target commercials, which, okay, is not, you know, maybe it's not the thing that I would wish for her, but that's going to, you know, she's going to get some bank from that. She's going to get some attention. She's playing on the commercials, and they're happening again this year. She's doing, I think, new ones this year.
Oh, yes.
She's playing sort of a variation of a character she plays in her stand-up a lot, the sort of iron-jawed, entitled white woman, who in this one really loves Christmas. So I think
I'm checking out now.
The fact that the universe is showering some attention on Maria Bamford makes up for at least 2 to 3 Real Housewives.
Nice.
I think the egregiously unwarranted attention.
That's the ratio.
Yeah, I think that's how it works out at the end. But seek her out.
My family's watching one of those ads this weekend, which has her setting up a bunch of those little cards that you can record into, and she was singing the Carol of the Bells into the cards.
Christmas is here. Ba la la la, ba la la la, Christmas is here, Christmas is here, ba la la la, ba la la la, ding dong, ba la la la, ba la la la, rum tummy, rum tummy, tummy, rum tummy, tummy, ho ho ho.
And then she walks away from all these cards with this look of just massive excitement and happiness on her face as she listens to them all sing the carol. It's really, really funny. And
really
we just giggled and giggled, my family. So I am 100% with you.
Normally when somebody who has a sort of niche appeal tries to break out of that niche appeal, the automatic nerd response would be to talk down and you know, fire up your nerd rage and say, sell out.
Right.
Because
how dare they eat food?
Exactly. And that would normally be my response because as we have... we have established I am a small, petty man with a black and tiny heart. But here, I am just so happy for her. I love seeing her on my television.
I agree. I concur. How about you, Trey?
I'm not going to belabor this, but I'm rooting for Julie Taymor right now.
Yeah.
Speaking of nerd rage and selling out.
Well, you should at least tell the people what
Julie
she's
Taymor
doing
is
right now.
The woman who directed The Lion King on Broadway. These many years ago, and she is currently in the thick of trying to get a $65 million production of Spider-Man, the musical, ready for a Broadway opening. And the reports out of Sunday night's preview were kind of disastrous, but I don't want to belabor that because it's kind of not fair to talk about it in any substantial way because they have 6 weeks of previews yet to go.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Didn't it get jeered like in the opening?
It got jeered in the house, but because it had shut down basically and stopped and was holding for 5 minutes.
It's interesting to see it covered, a preview covered as news because they have to do that because they can't review the damn thing.
Right, they can't review it, and there's meant to be a certain circumspection about how much you say about a project that's in development because it's not fair to the people who are, after all, trying to put it on its feet and walk it through and see it in front of an audience, engage the audience's reactions, and fine-tune the machine. The argument about this particular show is that it's not ready for even a preview audience yet. At least that's the argument that some people are making. But I think Julie Taymor is one of the few bona fide geniuses working both in commercial and non-commercial theater and in film if you've seen Titus or any of her other stuff, she's got a film of The Tempest coming out this holiday season mm-hmm. with Helen Mirren. She's incredibly intelligent. She's incredibly thoughtful. She is monumentally creative, and she is bold. Man, this woman is bold. She takes risks. She has visions that six other directors combined won't take in their entire career. And I just wish her the best of luck. If this falls apart, I'll be very sad for her.
Yeah.
But I will be glad that she tried it.
It was our own Linda Holmes who pointed out the similarities between the reports coming out of opening night and the This American Life episode called Fiasco.
Available on the interwebs, as I understand
On the interwebs. It's absolutely wonderful. Fiasco.
Well, and you know what? You never know, because... You never know. You get these projects all the time. Like, remember when like $1 billion had been spent on Avatar,
mm-hmm. and everyone was saying,
"It's going to be the biggest turkey."
Titanic. Same thing with Titanic.
Titanic was the same thing.
I would just like to point out that the same director was developing The Lion King in Minneapolis. I don't know, 14 years ago, whenever it was, when they were trying it out.
People laughed and laughed about The Lion King.
Well, the reports coming out of Minneapolis were this kind of overheated and crazy and, oh my God, it's a disaster. Mm-hmm. And you know what it turned out to be? Not a disaster. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be still running.
Yeah.
I think it's very smart to reserve.
Don't write that lady off.
For sure. All right, Stephen, how about you? Somebody you're pulling for.
Well, I took a slightly different approach.
Besides yourself.
Don't tell me it's going to be anyone who is beating up Brett Favre.
That's true. Whoever is sacking Brett Favre is somebody.
We're pulling for you.
We're pulling for
you, one of your very good friends who just so happens.
No, it is not one of my good friends either. It is the newest cast of Celebrity Rehab.
Oh.
Sure, of course. How can you not root for those people?
Who include, let's see, I got a cast list right in front of me.
Are any of them actual celebrities?
Well, okay, this is part of what I want to talk about. The cast is Jason Davis, who is an heir to Marvin Davis, who owned 20th Century. So basically a wealthy problem child.
Yes, he's a wealthy problem child.
Janice Dickinson.
Janice Dickinson!
The once and future.
Janice Dickinson! If you don't know who Janice Dickinson is, she was a supermodel of long ago who then was a judge on America's Next Top Model for a bunch of seasons and also appeared on The Surreal Life and some other reality
shows. I stopped watching America's Next Top Model when she stopped appearing on...
Yeah, Janice Dickinson
was
a pretty spectacularly crazy and very entertaining person.
Leif Garrett.
Leif Garrett, former teen idol who's been through several, I think, attempts to rehabilitate himself. Yeah,
apparently never been hotter.
Yeah, I have to say, I guess Stephen hasn't gotten around to watching it yet with work and so forth, but I actually did watch the first episode, and Leif Garrett really...
Is he the Conaway?
He's
the Jeff Conaway,
what
really?
Does that mean?
Inside joke alert.
No. Jeff Conaway is, he was on Taxi.
Jeff Conaway was on Taxi, and he played Kinnicky in Grease.
Sure, right.
Who he is. And he was on an earlier season of Celebrity Rehab, where he was barely coherent and very tragic.
Oh, see, now I understand.
Not doing so well.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, so that's the situation.
So Leif Garrett is the Conaway?
Oh, dear.
Ah, that's a shame. the no star on Celebrity Rehab shines brighter than Frankie Lanz, the biological mother of R&B singer Keisha Cole.
That is literally her entire claim to fame is that she's Keisha Cole's mother.
Wow.
Yeah. Rachel Yucatel.
Is she in rehab already?
Some people, I feel like their careers start out in rehab.
Well, but
the first I hear of them.
But I will say, spoiler alert, she partly says she has a love addiction.
Oh. But isn't that, there's a whole separate spin-off of that show for people with love addiction. She is a tabloid celebrity and socialite who has managed the VIP sections of some of the most successful clubs in New York and Las Vegas.
Yeah, right.
So how have I never heard of her?
Yeah.
Her claim to fame is that she was instrumental in the Tiger Woods business.
I see. Okay.
She's also a special correspondent.
I hate that I know this.
She's also a special correspondent on Nightlife for Extra.
Oh.
I should have known that. And finally, Eric Roberts.
Eric Roberts, for those of you who don't know, is an actual real actor who was in Star 80 and some other good movies, is also Julia Roberts' brother, and has kind of fallen on hard times over time. time. Mm. But certainly at one point was considered a very seriously promising young actor at one time.
So, Linda, give us your thoughts on Celebrity Rehab.
Well, I have complex thoughts about this because I have a massive crush on Dr. Drew. And I despite the fact that I do not require rehab, I would very much like Dr. Drew to give me a lot of advice about getting over my inner pain
and childhood
and all that stuff and, you know, making a clean start for myself and mm-hmm. so forth. I like Dr. Drew really a lot, even though I know that he's crass and terrible and I know all those things intellectually. But I actually find that
But, I mean,
show...
his persona is not necessarily crass.
Correct.
He's
very nurturing.
He exudes level-headedness.
He's very nurturing.
Amid Adam Carolla yeah, and various...
He's very smart.
Speaking of vocal performances.
Yeah.
Anyway, I do like Dr. Drew a lot, and I find that show weirdly hypnotic. And when I have friends who are watching it, I cannot not have conversations with them about, you know, did you see what Jeremy London was doing? Did you see what Leif Garrett's hair looked like, et cetera, et cetera.
But, I mean, that show is always sort of brought out as the prototypical most bottom feeding.
It's not most right. bottom feeding unless you haven't seen Bridal Plastic.
I was going to say, not in the week of Bridal Plastic.
but having seen some of it, it does not to me seem that way. It seems to be.
It is and it isn't. It sort of depends on how genuine you want to think it is. I mean, if you want to think these are really people who have hit bottom and are coming in for rehab and he's a real doctor, then it actually can educate you in some ways about, it can be interesting to observe mm-hmm. how hard it is, essentially, to get people to change a guy. If you could see the look of skepticism that I'm getting from Glenn Welch right
now. Well, I'm directing this at Stephen. If we're brutally honest, if we're going to be brutally honest, and let's do.
Okay.
Stephen, you're not really pulling for these people to succeed because that would be pretty boring television. You want them to crash and burn, don't you?
No.
You can't watch Celebrity Rehab and want the people to crash and burn.
If they crash and burn, and Mike Katziff, our esteemed producer, just held his thumb and forefinger close together as if to call BS on my... The problem is if you crash and burn on Celebrity Rehab, you really could literally die.
Yeah.
And I don't right. wish for
it's no fun. The people who do badly on Celebrity Rehab, Jeff Conaway, that is not fun. That okay. was not fun. I wanted him to do better than he did. It was not fun.
I have found it to be sort of strangely compelling.
It is strangely compelling. We might have to make you watch it. It's not uplifting.
No, good, it's good, not good. Uplifting.
It's not uplifting.
No,
it's
lift it up.
Weird. We might have to make you watch a little bit of it. At some point, we're going to have some sort of TV watching marathon where we can share some of these things with each other so that we can all be conversant in the same pathetic and pitiful things. Yeah. Anyway, the person that I am pulling for, if we may move on from Celebrity Rehab.
No.
Is also
make
from
a Dr. Drew joke here. But,
is also from the world of reality television, but higher up on the food chain. The Food Network show Ace of Cakes
okay.
is entering its 10th and final season.
Wow.
And I have to say, for all that there are too many cake shows and too yes. many baking shows, I love me some Ace of Cakes.
Mm-hmm.
Ace of Cakes, which stars this guy named Duff Goldman, who has this bakery where all his friends work. For some reason, they are really nice people. They have a great time together. They are entertaining. They are creative. And it's a very, very enjoyable show. So, I am very confident that the Food Network will find another project for Duff. I am not worried about Duff. Here's who I'm pulling for. Mary Alice.
Yay!
Mary Alice
explain,
is
please.
Duff's sort of sidekick, co-owner. It's really hard
office
to explain
manager,
what
really.
She's kind of an office, but she's also a creative. Mm-hmm. But she kind of keeps the sanity level there. But she's also a lot of fun. She's really warm and funny, and maybe just one of the most to me endearing people on any reality show.
The postcard cake is for a friend of mine, Joanna.
We were in ninth grade together.
And when she came here for her appointment, I hadn't seen her in like 13 or 14 years. We were in Fiddler on the Roof together. At a Catholic girls' school. It was awesome.
My fear is that they will ship Duff off to some other project and they will leave Mary Alice at
they
the cake
would
store.
Be fools.
Ideally, I want them to stay together because I think it's their partnership that I enjoy so much. Stop laughing. But if not, then I want Mary Alice to have her own show or whatever it is that she wants to do. So I'm pulling for Mary Alice when this is all over. When this whole Ace of Cakes thing is over there, Mary Alice, I'm with you. And I want you to get your own show, or I want you to follow Duff wherever he's going. And if they leave Mary Alice out in the cold, then me and the Food Network, we're going to have words.
I'll have you back there.
So as always, now that we have explained to you the people that we are pulling for, we would encourage you to tell us in the comments the people that you are pulling for. Unless it is, of course, Brett Favre.
That's right. That will not be.
That we don't want to hear.
No, we'll just
wait, in the comments where, Linda?
In the comments at the Monkey See, our blog at NPR, which is at npr.org/Monkey See.
You can also find every episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour in one convenient place if you go to npr.org/PCHH or, as I like to render it, npr.org/.
This public service announcement brought to you.
The spit shield, the spit shield in front of my microphone exactly. Is so grateful.
The
right
flex
now.
Of spittle that have arced across the studio.
So I think we have time for a quick round of things that are making us happy this week. So let's whip around and go the other way. Stephen, is there anything that is making you happy this week?
I've actually got a really, really quick one. Very, very, very sure. Minor. And that is that in the previews before taking my kids to see Tangled, they showed the preview for Tron Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And what is making me happy is the brief conversation that I had with my son later that evening in which I tried to gauge his interest in, quote, seeing Tron. And he replied, "Dad, it's Tron Legacy." And what is making me happy is Tomorrow's Nerds.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Still? Again? Still happy. All right, how about you, Trey?
I do have a thing that's making me happy. But first, I want to warn parents that this is the part, if you haven't already shooed your children out of the room when Linda started drooling over Dr. Drew.
Oh, come on.
Now, this next bit may be mildly child-unfriendly, because what's making me happy is sex.
Oh, what?
MILF sex. Wait. MILF sex, to be specific. And in particular, Hamlet's MILF.
Okay. I need more.
That's what she said.
I don't believe. Linda Holmes. God. Linda Holmes of all people.
Oh.
No.
Beneath you, Linda Holmes.
I have no idea what's going on here, but Trey.
I can't believe that I am the one sitting here saying,
with
never.
With nothing to contribute yet. All right. Let me attempt to put this back on the rails. There is a thing called script tease. It is a recurring feature on a Time Out blog, specifically on Time Out New York. It's called Upstaged, this blog. And last week, as their script tease feature, they posted an excerpt from a play called Gertrude the Cry. It's a retelling of Hamlet that kind of looks at the story, comes at it from kind of the same angle that John Updike used in a novel called Gertrude and Claudius. Which is to say that it looks at the story through the eyes and the internal monologues of Hamlet's mother and his stepfather, Claudius. So it kind of explains who they are, why they would kill a king and take his throne in a way that makes sense of them as people much more than Shakespeare does, because these characters are sort of famously underdrawn in Shakespeare. Gertrude the Cry is a play by Howard Barker, who is this incredibly fierce and daring British writer. He's seriously, seriously dark, much more interested in ambiguity than in predictability and clarity and a guided audience response, which, as you can imagine, makes him immensely commercial.
Yes.
Mm. I've seen a couple of his things, but I've never seen this play, and it intrigues me highly. They did a reading of it this week in New York. I missed it. It was last night, Monday night, with F. Murray Abraham and Jan Maxwell, who's another one of those Broadway veterans who's kind of not a giant name,
mm-hmm.
But who is really, really respected. Anyway, I was away from my bookmarks when they posted the most recent edition of Script Tease, and to stumble across this little script of this bracingly, staggeringly vital play was kind of like being confronted by something really shocking in the middle of an otherwise perfectly ordinary back from a long weekend day. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, always a good thing. So Script Tease is what's making
Time Out New York
making me happy. Yes.
Script Tease.
It should also be noted while we're plugging Time Out New York,
mm-hmm.
that Time Out New York is the home of our favorite advice columnist.
That's right. Mm-hmm. My dear pal, Miss Sarah Bunting.
Who is awesome.
Who is awesome. Has been writing her own advice column for many, many years, has recently started an advice column at Time Out New York, which is called Tough Love, I believe.
Hmm. Yes.
All right. How about you, Glenn?
Oh, I'm getting a little tired of Stephen promoting his friends, even though they are all deserving. And your friend, of course, Sarah Bunting, is mm-hmm. awesome. I'm going to promote my friend. The one and only Alan Schurstel writes a blog feature called Studies in Crap. And it is you can find it on the Pitch blog at Kansas City or the LA
oh,
Weekly
sure.
also, or the Village Voice also runs this feature. He basically goes to thrift shops, finds some horrible thing, and blogs about it and makes a great deal of fun about it. He finds 1970s sex advice manuals. He finds... He finds Rambo, the coloring book. He finds screeds from various preachers of various degrees of crazy. Mm. And he also finds horrible self-published novels.
Oh.
Those are perhaps the most fun.
Yes.
So it's very funny. You can follow him and it at Studies in Crap, at Studies in Crap on Twitter to get everything that he's doing. He publishes twice a week, I think, Studies in Crap, and then he also does this thing for LA Weekly called LA Bus Rants, where he basically just sits and listens while people say have really troubling conversations on Los Angeles' public transit system.
Often with themselves, I imagine.
Often with themselves, but usually not. It's fascinating. So
so he engages these people in conversation?
He does not. He's
just
an observer. He's a fly on the very, very dirty wall.
He's an anthropologist.
Exactly. Of crazy. Yeah. So at Studies in Crap.
At Studies in Crap. All right. My thing making me happy this week, it's actually an update to a previous thing that was making me happy a few weeks ago. And that is that Salon.com recently ran an interview with Miss Catherine Chloe
Cahoon. Oh.
Yay.
Who did the wonderful How to Date European Men videos that we discussed on the podcast a few weeks ago. And these videos, if you have not seen them, are so outrageously strange. And they're just so weird as she gives this chipper little dating advice walking around in a floral dress that there was kind of a massive debate going on as to whether she could possibly be for real or whether she was an extremely brilliant comedian. Mm-hmm. And the thing that is so incredibly wonderful is that she's real.
Yeah, I believe,
which is what I expected, because when they interviewed her, she sort of said, well, of course the videos are supposed to be funny. Of course the videos are supposed to be silly. Right? But she means, like, I'm making a silly commercial for my real product. She doesn't actually not mean to be telling you how to date European men, because she totally does. And she doesn't mean to be not advising you about what colors to wear if you go to the running of the bulls, because she totally does.
Wait. I'm assuming not red?
Yeah.
I forget what her exact advice is, but there is specific color advice about what to wear to certain events. So she, although she thinks the videos are funny, she doesn't appreciate the specific way in which they're funny. She means them to be sort of exaggerated, like, hey, you know, like, I've got these two guys coming up to me offering me beers, and I know in real life that would never happen, but it's a funny scene, but
it's the difference, of course, between being laughed with and laughed at.
Right,
she's saying, of course, people laugh with me.
Yes.
Right?
She's an unreliable narrator.
But the thing is, she's clearly a very, very happy person, and she is clearly perfectly satisfied with her lot, and she knows that people are laughing, but she just thinks, oh, those are just people who don't understand that it's funny. So I just was personally nothing but delighted to discover that Miss Catherine Chloe Cahoon is the real McCoy when it comes to dating advice about European men. So that's my thing making me happy this week.
Catherine Chloe Cahoon.
Catherine Chloe Cahoon.
Yet again, a twofer.
And the realness thereof. And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. And you can follow Trey at Trey Graham, which Stephen, much to the delight, it turns out, of some of our listeners who like an earworm now and then, Stephen likes to render as
Trey with an E, then Graham like the cracker.
I'm going to have to write a harmony line for them.
Yeah, we got to work on it.
It's
eventually
true.
It's going to be this whole barbershop.
Someone's going to send us an MP3 of themselves.
Please, barbershop quartets,
performing.
Send it.
What are we doing?
How big is the demographic of barbershop? Are you imagining, Trey? You just said barbershop quartets.
I know.
Anyway, you can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow our illustrious producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, I should mention, provides our beautiful and lovely in-and-out music, which some of you are very fond of. And that's it. And so please come and follow us and sing our little tunes to yourself, because nothing would make us happier.
It's true.
So thanks to all of you guys for being here, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to everybody, and we will see all of you next week.